Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Welcome, everybody. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we broadcast from, once again, 13th time from Bayfield, Wisconsin, the Bayfield Pavilion, for celebrating Bayfield in Bloom. At certainly this time of the year, on my birthday week, it's always the one thing that I really look forward to every year is to be here to talk with you about gardening, and certainly gardening in northern Wisconsin, but across the state as well. And it's always wonderful to be able to kick off Bayfield in Bloom. As we drove through yesterday, I saw all the daffodils and tulips that are in bloom already, and there's a whole lot more to come. I'm sure of that. This is just the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. And so it's a wonderful opportunity to kind of highlight what's going on in this part of the world, and also to say hi to a whole bunch of people. There's, I think, one empty chair, but then there are some people standing. So it's really great. And great to have three guys who have been with us a lot over the years to celebrate Bayfield in Bloom with us and to answer your questions. And we can cover a whole broad range of things today with our guests. Jason Fishbach, one of our guests, is the UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. Jason, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Sure. Welcome to Bayfield, Larry.
Don Kissinger. Don is Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Don, welcome back.
Appreciate it, Larry. And yes, we do have a full house here today.
Yeah, full house. And Art Odie has been with us, I think, pretty much all 13 years. Art is a horticulture consultant. He's semi-retired now from Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. And it's great to see you again, Art.
Glad to be here.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to see this wonderful crowd. And as you listen to the show today, I hope you'll call in with your questions and comments. I wish you could see. Maybe somebody will take a picture. We could post it up on our Facebook page of me here in front of the microphone with a lemon blueberry cake. Oh, birthday cake from the Fat Radish of Bayfield. It's donated by the Ashland and Bayfield Master Gardeners, led by Joanne Collins, I'm pretty sure, had her hand in this. And with one of the most beautiful watercolor cards you're ever going to see by Don Alani. It's just absolutely beautiful. And just for the audience's sake, I'm going to put this up and show it. Look at that. Isn't that, have I got it right side up? We'll get that up. We'll get that up on our Facebook page, and we'll post that in Chris will have that posted in just a matter of minutes. If you have a question for us today in the audience, certainly raise your hand, and he'll come around with a microphone, Chris will, and you can ask your question. As you listen on the radio today, I hope you'll join in. And you know what? There's that same old number to call. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you, and I always look forward to the questions that we get. We have some questions to start with. I know Jennifer emailed and said, it's been raining here in western Wisconsin. Can I till my garden tomorrow? Well, Jason?
Well, this is an easy one to figure it out. Just go out and grab a handful of soil, and if you kind of crimple it in your hands and it falls apart, go ahead and do your tillage. Typically, if our sandy or loam or sandy soils, you can till right away. If you've got any clay in it, you're just doing yourself a whole lot of damage if you go in there and till too early, and then you're planting in clay balls, and that's no fun.
Yeah. And just you mentioned clay, and Jackie on Facebook had a question on Facebook. What spring flowers will tolerate clay soil? She planted bulbs last year, and they didn't come up. Could be a number of reasons why they might not have come up, Art Odie.
Well, our daffodils and tulips here certainly do acceptable and are mostly clay sandy soils. It must have been some other factor involved there.
What about depth of planting on bulbs? Is that an issue?
Well, I like to plant daffodil, I'm talking, of course, daffodils about our big daffodil displays here in town, but I like to plant them a little deep if I can, because they come up a little later and they're not competing with the snowstorms.
Yeah, for this part of the world, that's probably pretty good advice. What about tulips, Jason Fishbach?
Yeah, it's because of the number of bulbs and the number of varieties and the variation that we have, I think the good rule of thumb is to find online. We've got these resources on how deep to plant the various bulbs. There's just so many to keep track of that. Get yourself a good guide, and it'll show you. You know, typically it's going to be based on the size of the bulb and the variety, but you can look online to get the right depth for whatever variety and species that you're going to plant.
Okay, there we go. We have callers already online with questions for us. Again, the number for you to call as you listen in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Don Kissinger, I wanted to get you involved here as well as we start the show. One of the things that everybody's concerned about, especially in our urban forests, is EAB or emerald ash borer. What's the status of emerald ash borer across the state, but it's particularly in this part of the state, in the north?
Well, in the north, as most people know, last fall we had a trap find, actually. It wasn't found in a tree in the city of Rhinelander in Oneida County, and the closest outlier from there was in the Green Bay or close to here in the Superior area. So I guess that kind of shows folks that emerald ash borer could be anywhere. And the fact that you really don't see a lot of the signs and symptoms for maybe 2 or 3 years afterwards, be quite vigilant looking at your trees. And one of the telltale signs with EAB, if it's been there for a while, is seeing what we call flecking or blonding on the trunks of the trees, and that's from the woodpeckers going for the larva.
Oh, okay. All right, well, we've got more callers online. Joanne in Wausau, we'll turn to you next. Thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I live in the city in Wausau in a side-by-side duplex, and last year my neighbor volunteered to till up a part of my lawn that had been, the grass had been killed because one of the former tenants had left a tent up there all year and killed the grass underneath, so I thought, perfect spot for a garden. I planted tomato plants, I planted beet seeds, and I planted zucchini plants. They all looked beautiful, and all of a sudden they just started wilting and wilting, and they died. Everything died. And somebody said there's something called verisilium wilt in the soil that may have caused it, but I'm afraid to put anything in there this year.
Wow. There's a myriad reasons why that could be the case. Jason, there wasn't a black walnut tree nearby, was there?
No, there isn't. No, it's behind a lilac tree.
That's because of the range of different plant families that died of the same symptoms, it'd be unlikely that it's, a biological, because you'd expect at least one of those to hang on or do okay. So something else is going on. You know, if it's been compacted over the years and it dried out at some point during the year, then everything just starts to suffer and the plants just dried out because of the compacted soil. That could be part of it. You know, who knows if it was a tent, what else was stored in the tent, if there may have been chemicals. But even if it's a chemical problem, you wouldn't have expected to see growth for a while and then have it die. It would have just not grown at all. So, yeah, this one, I don't have a good answer in terms of what happened. It seems, you know, you're going to have to let your plants tell you that that's probably not a good spot for a garden and probably back to grass. You know, testing for chemicals, residues is expensive and it's hard to do and it's hard to get a definitive answer. So I think you're just better off going back to grass and maybe resting it for a few more years and then try it again on a small scale.
I would watch for any weed killer application, 2,4-D, 2,4-5-T, that sort of thing. Can be devastating, and it can drift a long way, and it depends on when it's being applied and how hot it is and how moist it is. I've seen just otherwise inexplicable things happen with chemicals put on lawns that have caused damage that you really had to look twice to determine that that's what it was.
Oh. That's a great point. Art, because the, you know, if it's the first year for a garden, maybe the neighbors or whoever was taking care of the lawn didn't know and didn't change their practices to take into consideration that garden. So it maybe could have been an herbicide overspray or drift of some kind.
I see so many, not to decry any contractors particularly, but I see an awful lot of kind of negligent waving around of spray wands. And
it's stuff really that you really problems. Have to be careful about that. Yeah, that's for sure. So thanks, Joanne, for calling. I appreciate your call. We're not quite sure what happened there, but I think it's probably not bad advice. If you're going to grow something, if that's the only place you have to grow something, one thing you could do is stick some straw bales out there and do some straw bale gardening right on top of it. You're not going to have, you shouldn't have an issue if you had something like straw bales, but you'd want to get going pretty quickly to get the bales seasoned.
Or potentially bringing in soil and having a raised bed above that too, and new soil could still accommodate that area for gardening since it's already been tilled to this point and you've got a different soil that's brought in.
Yeah, that's another way to do it. So a couple of options that I wish you well. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Carolyn next in Manawa. Carolyn, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Okay, last year I had about 100 tulips come up, and the foliage was beautiful. And then, like, later on I realized that I never saw any tulips, and I went out there and gone. I mean, all the things. So this year I went out there, and the foliage again was up beautiful, and I noticed something was biting on them. So I put up a bunch of little wind chimes, figuring it would scare away whatever's doing it. But I went out there again today, and they're almost all gone again. Is there anything to keep critters out of your... I live in a rural area. There's a lot of critters. Is there anything to save my tulips?
Plant daffodils. The deer won't eat them.
Yeah, it could be. It could be deer. It could be squirrels, couldn't it? It could be rabbits.
And there are products out there that you smell god awful that you can put on these that will keep a lot of these critters away. I know in the spring of the year I have balsams and I also have a lot of flowers at my home, and I put that out there and they do a great job. You just want to make sure that you're going to have at least a full 24 hours of no rain so it can dry on there.
Yeah, not a bad idea. We have a question from the audience. Hi, what's your name?
Jane Horn.
Jane?
Mm-hmm.
What's your question?
I'm looking for a small tree for my front yard, mm-hmm. and I live in Zone 4.
Small tree for the front yard.
Oh, lots of good choices. What community are you near?
I live south of the Twin Cities.
There's so many that... It's hard to even start. As far as things that are native or mostly native, mountain ash are fine. They won't get too big, and they flower, and they have wonderful fruit. They're wildlife trees. Ornamental pear, amelanchier species, the juneberries, particularly the tree-like juneberry. There are a lot of Ohio buckeyes that and varieties of Ohio buckeyes that will grow in your area. We have a very nice one in town that's hardy with us, so it'd certainly be hardy with you, called Fort McNair hybrid buckeye. You probably have red buds would do okay there. It might even have flowering dogwoods do all right there. There's just a whole host of things.
Yeah.
There's another couple more. Nannyberry viburnum tree form is very nice, and that's a native. A non-native, but if you're in a rural area, I'm thinking that there's probably not too many of them out there. In cities, we're starting to plant them a little too much, but your Japanese tree lilacs, they do have very beautiful white panicles in the springtime, and they have a darker trunk to them with the white lenticels, so they have really a neat form there. Where you're at, depending on if you have a loamy soil or... the clay soil, that's going to dictate a little bit, but you have a pretty big potpourri there.
Thank you very much for that question. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk, broadcasting from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, for Bayfield in Bloom, with a wonderful audience and three great experts as well. Jason Fishbach, our UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. We've got Don Kissinger, Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and Art Odie, who is a horticulture consultant, semi-retired from Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. Questions for them, give us a call again, 800-642-1234, email at talk@WPR.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And for our wonderful audience here, if you just want to raise your hand, Chris Molina will be out there with a microphone, and you can ask your questions.
Larry, I have a comment on this expert business.
Yeah.
I was introduced as an expert once and felt very good about it until the person who introduced me explained what an expert was.
Yeah.
An expert is a drip who has traveled a long way from home.
Oh, yeah, but you guys are experts. You're real experts. And we have somebody here in the audience who has a question. What's your name? Hi.
Hi, my name is Carol. I have a vacant forest around my place, and these cattails are growing up all over. I'd like to know how you can eradicate them, if that's even possible. I have the mangy things with me here.
Yeah, and I'm afraid there is one cattail in Wisconsin that is not a native and has created some problems, and it's probably the one you've got.
It starts out green, like a little horse mane tail, and then it ends up to these things like this. Only that's a bad one. And it has seed heads, and I'm sure that this is what's blowing. I didn't notice it really until this spring. It's coming out crazy. And they look like this when they start, little tiny things, and they get real tall like that.
Yeah, real tall.
And then it turns into this.
Yeah, and this is what she's showing is not something you want to see in your backyard, as an example. And Jason, and I probably could take a closer look at it and come up with it, but we were just talking about this on a show the other day. We were talking about invasive plants, and there is one cattail that's an invasive that has created some problems. But what do you think, Jason?
Well, from what I could see from here, it could be Tansy equisetum. Looks like equisetum to me.
Okay. Jason's taking a look at it right now.
So these are most of these invasive weeds that are rhizomatous, which means that's code word for almost impossible to get rid of. That's a problem. So it's a persistence is really the only way. If it's limited in its scale, hand pulling and weeding can be effective. Otherwise, you're looking at some sort of an herbicide treatment, realistically, just given the labor involved, and a repeated herbicide application. So we can work with you after to talk more specifically about.
I hesitated to spray because I know robins are ground creepers, and they just bring that spray back to their nest and the young. So I'm trying to find some miraculous way.
And that's why these rhizomatous species are such a pain, because there's no good answer. If it's limited in scale, it's manageable. You can do things like smothering, hand pulling, and you don't have to use the herbicides. But early and often, and hopefully you can keep at it. Now, equisetum is...
Okay, yep. All right. I'll try it. Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. And you want to get them before they seed, or if you can pull when they're small, is that better, probably?
Yeah, for sure. Earlier in the year and earlier in the infestation.
Yeah, that would be my guess, too. You can join in again, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Jonathan next on the line from Fox River Valley. Hi, Jonathan. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Good morning. Thank you for the program. Wish I was there with you in person.
I wish you were, too.
Yeah, Bayfield, the whole area is just beautiful. I encourage everyone to make a trip this summer. My parents are moving out of their home, and I want to move some of the raspberry bushes in their garden to my home. And help me out.
Okay. Jason, you want to take that?
Well, the official party line is you don't want to transplant raspberries because they accumulate viruses over time, and you're just moving the viruses with them, so you're better off starting over. Oftentimes, the varieties that have been that you know are your parents or your grandparents are the same varieties we plant today, so they're not necessarily anything special. Okay, so that's the party line. The if you want to transplant them, the sooner in the year or toward the end of the year, the better. Now, I think, especially up here in the north, depending on where you are, even if they're a few inches tall, you can still transplant those crowns, and they'll do fine for you that first year. But earlier in the year, the better, or after they've gone dormant in the fall to transplant them.
All right. There we go. And we have another question from the audience. Let's go. Hello. What's your name?
Sylvia Whalen from Ashland. And my question is, I have to plant grass this year, and I don't want just plain grass. I want to have a mixture with clover. I live in an area that's sandy, and last fall I put down literal tons of shredded maple leaves, which I planned to till in, and now I have the topsoil compost mixture to put in. And I'm just wondering what ratio clover to grass seed would I use? Is it like 3-1? Or I'm going to plant like the small clover that's got the white flower that only gets 4 to 6 inches tall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what was growing naturally in the other areas in my yard because of the huge maple and oak trees I have there.
Yeah. Might have been there from one of the old seeds. The old grass seed mixes always had clover. If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so the trick with trying to get the right ratio is you can put the right seed mix down, but it really depends on the conditions at germination, which one wins. So even if it's a 50-50 mix, you're not guaranteed to get a 50-50 mix. So, but that's generally a good rule of thumb. No more than half should be the Dutch white clover. And what you'll want to try to do is what's called a stale seedbed approach. And so especially when you're bringing in soil or compost, you're going to have weed seeds. So spread it all out. And when we've got a nice early season like we do this year, you've got some time. So spread it all out. Let the weed seeds germinate. And then very carefully so these things, you should just see a wisp of green. They're just barely germinated. Very gently with the rake, kill those weeds, right? You don't want to get deep because you don't want to bring up more weed seeds. Or in some cases, this is an option to use a contact herbicide, even something like vinegar, acetic acid, if you want to use an organic product to kill it, because you're trying to just kill those weed seeds that germinate at the surface, and then put your seed mix down. You're going to likely end up with a much better germination and fewer weeds to start with. So roughly half is a good mix on that. Grass and clover mix.
Yeah, I let the soil just sit over the winter pretty much bare to let all the weeds germinate that wanted to. In sections, hardly nothing has germinated. And then with the compost, I've had it sitting there for 2 seasons, and it hasn't generated too much weed seed yet. You know, I had it covered purposely. I didn't want to spread it, you know, because I wanted to let the seeds kind of kill through the heat of composting.
Sure.
Yeah, that's great. And so hopefully all your winter annuals, you're past that. They would have germinated in the fall, and now you're just waiting for these spring and summer annuals, the lamb's quarters and pigweeds to germinate. Knock those back, and then you can seed.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks very much for that question. And let's go back to the phones. Jay and Eau Claire, it is your turn. Hi, Jay.
Hi, actually, it's Jay.
All right, what can we do for you? Hi, can we do for you?
I have a 95-year-old mother who just loves Hubbard squash, and I'm going to try growing it for her this year. Just wondering if there's anything special I got to do for the soil or anything like that.
Okay, and you're in the Eau Claire area. Hubbard squash. Shouldn't be all that hard to grow Hubbard squash, I wouldn't think.
No, just have take some time because you have some time. You don't want to put these out till your last frost, sometime early June or end of May. So you've got time to amend that soil, get a real nice rotted compost mixed in. They really, squash respond really well to organic soils, so put that compost in. And then just make sure you have adequate water over the year. Now, some folks will put a plastic mulch underneath their squash plants, help keep the weeds down, especially when the vines really start to stretch out. So other than that, good watering and good high-quality compost at planting, and you shouldn't have a problem.
All right. All right, there we go. Let's take another question from the audience. Hi.
Hi. I've heard of a recent strawberry plant pest that was recently discovered in the Wentworth, Wisconsin area that's very damaging. Do you have any information on that?
So Wentworth up in Douglas County. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So I have not heard anything other than spotted wing Drosophila showed up the last couple of years.
That's
probably
I think
that.
That's it.
Yeah, so that's a, you know, it's a nasty invasive species that's come in. And the strawberries typically you can get through that first picking or two without having the little worm show up. Really your only option is to spray an insecticide. Now, you know, some of the organic insecticides like Pyganic will work. But you can also cool these down. As soon as you put them in the refrigerator, the larvae stop growing. And let's just pretend that they're not in there, because, right? Or you end up freezing the berries. It's a pest that we, it's not good at all. And it's really changed the way fruit's being produced in the state right now, because typically we've not had to spray with ripe fruit, and now we have to. Now, so far we have some good organic products that work well, and Pyganic's one of them. But you just have to be on it. So hopefully you can get through the first few pickings before they show up, because strawberries typically are ahead of them.
Yeah, there we go.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that question. Emil in Wautoma, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I got a question about semi dwarf apple trees. I planted a couple of years ago, and this winter the top part died off, and it's right above the graft, the living. So what do I need to do to get that tree back on track?
So if it died right above the graft, you've hopefully this spring here you'll have some latent buds that'll break, and you'll get a new stem on that wood that's above the graft, and you can just train that as your replacement stem. If the buds, and most likely this is what'll happen, if the buds break below that graft union, now you just have a rootstock growing, and it's not going to make very good apples. Now, you could let that grow and then graft onto it next spring, or you could do what's called chip bud grafting here in July. Look that one up online. That's something that's doable to go back to the cultivar that you want. Otherwise, you still have time this spring just to start over and put a replacement tree in.
Yep, that's another way to do it for sure. Thanks, Emil, for calling. Terry in Abbotsford. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering, can you replant mature apple trees? I mean, we just want to move them from one side of the yard to the other.
How mature?
Well, probably 8, 12 years old.
Ooh. That'd be a big
equipment project, I'm afraid. Not worth it.
I don't see how you could do it without a huge expense. And I'm not sure you'd... The success rate, I would think, would be
right.
Low.
Your success rate is low. The expense to do it in a way that at least gives you a chance that it would survive is probably not worth it, especially with the size of bare root or potted plants you can buy now. You'd spend a whole lot less money on a new tree instead of trying to move that one.
Yeah. I guess, too, if you're going to do it, you want to do it before they start budding out, because then that's going to be putting more stress on the tree at that point in time. And if you do, you're not going to have to dig real deep, but you want to dig wider to get a good root system. But it's going to be, and I look at trees on caliper or diameter. If you have your diameter of your trunk is more than probably 3 inches, it's going to be a big task for you to do that, because those roots from that 3-inch tree, which has been established, you said, over 6-8 years, are probably 10, 15, 20 feet out from the trunk in all directions. So I think Jason has a good advice there. You might want to go to the store and get something else and put it in there.
Yeah. Sorry for that news, but thank you very much for asking that question and calling in. Danny and Ocado up next. Hi, Danny. Thank you for calling.
Hello. hey, I got a question about, I have a semi-dwarf Honeycrisp. I live in the O'Connell area. I had another tree. I can't remember what it was. The deer got at it. But I'm curious as to what trees, other apple trees I can plant that'll cross-pollinate with that Honeycrisp. And then second question to that is how to keep the deer away from them trees, if possible.
8-foot fence works. go ahead, Jason.
So, you know, all you need is two apple trees. It can even be the same variety if need be, but generally having a couple different varieties is good, especially if you can find a disease-resistant variety. Anything with the word free in it, like red free, would be resistant to apple scab. In terms of deer, I mean, there's it's exclusion of some form or another. So an 8-foot fence around the whole yard and be done with it for good, or you put up an individual fence around that tree. Now, you can have some success, especially when they're young, to put a deer repellent spray on it before the apples are on, before they're bearing trees. So that's an option.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate that call. We have... I bet we have more callers online. I just lost my screen here for a second. We'll get it back. Roddy from the Upper Peninsula called and said her specific tank field is in a sunny area. Could she put a raised bed above it? Or her septic, I'm sorry, her septic tank field is in a sunny area. Could she put a raised bed above her septic tank field? A raised flower bed, maybe?
Generally, it's a good idea to stay off that septic mound drain field. So I would say no. If that's the only place you can have anything flowering, yeah, you could get by with some flowering mixes or annuals. But generally, it's just best to stay away from it. It was a big investment to put that in, and you don't want to mess it up.
Yeah. Sometimes prairie plants can be – I know, I believe you got, the DNR has recommended some prairie plantings for over the top, but
– Yeah, I think go to the website potentially and get information on that. But, yeah, that might be a viable option.
I'm actually pretty sure that there are some that way. Well, we have – yeah.
Most of the prairie plants have – very, very deep root system, yeah. So be very cautious.
Yeah, but it seems to work pretty well. I think Prairie Nursery maybe have something on its website that talks about it. But anyway, let's take another question from the audience. Hi, what's your name?
Hi, my name is Terry, and I'm from Superior. Mm-hmm. I like hostas, but I really dislike the hosta flower stalks, and I cut them off every year. Am I doing any damage to those plants?
No, I don't think so. No,
not at all. In fact, you might just be reinvigorating the plants because they're not putting energy into those flowers. So really no problem.
Very good question. I never thought about that. I'm not the biggest fan of them either. So let's go to Don in Hartford. Hi, Don.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It can't help me anymore because we sold our house and we're now living in a condo. But my wife and I often vacation up on Madeline Island around Father's Day, and we drive around and we see these beautiful lupin spikes just everywhere. They're in ditches, they're in yards, and we had prairie plants that we try to grow in Shawna when we lived there, and they just never did anything. We might get them one year, they might get 6-8 inches tall, and the next year they didn't show up. We tried planting again. It was originally sandy soil that we had some heavy topsoil put on top of. Some were in sunny spots, some were in partial shade, but they never really did anything for us. And so I kind of wondered what we did wrong and what they're doing so right up on Madeline Island.
Art Odie.
I don't think you did anything wrong. They probably showed up in your neighbor's yard. They they don't want to stay where they are planted. They just travel around. That's not a good answer, I suppose. But I think for myself, I think that the lupins are best enjoyed in a natural environment, where they do move around and they do come back. And I think they're kind of questionable as real garden plants. I know a lot of people do well with them, but I prefer to look at them in nature, and they don't make good cut flowers.
They don't. No. Let's thank you for that question, Don. Appreciate it. Let's take another question from the audience. Hi. Your name?
Hi. My name is Chris. I live just south of Bayfield. I'm okay. A vegetable and flower gardener. And this time of year, and even a little later, it seems my biggest problem are cutworms. They, you know, cut down everything from carrots, beets, beans. I have learned to wrap tender transplants with paper towel around the stem. But is there anything that I'm missing other than just replanting when they're there?
Wow. Jason?
So if you can, during the growing season, trying to keep the grassy weeds down because the moths will want to lay eggs in those areas. Cutworms, some people have terrible problems with cutworms. Other people don't ever have a problem. And on the sandier ground, you tend to have a little bit more cutworm issues. There is a product called Sluggo Plus, which has some spinosad in it that can be effective. And it's it works well for repelling slugs, but it also works for cutworms. So that's a product you could try.
All right, excellent. Let's go to Susan in Oregon next. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm just pulling over on the highway because I was driving, but I'm over at the park now. I have a very old rhubarb plant. Well, actually, it came originally. We cut a rhubarb out of my grandmother's old garden many years ago, transplanted it to my parents' yard. It was there for about 35 years. Now I have it at my house, but it's doing so well. I want to transplant it again, and I'm thinking, is this too late in the year now? Is it better in the spring to transplant or in the fall? What is the best time to transplant it?
Rhubarb does pretty good.
Yep. How big are those leaves right now?
You know what? It's at my old property, and I haven't visited it for a couple weeks now, but I know the last time I was there, the leaves were starting to get pretty big. This is one of those plants that has these huge elephant ear leaves, you know, and really thick stems. It's not the common rhubarb that has those real thin stems and the little leaves, and I really treasure that plant. But I think I'm going to guess it's probably already at least a foot tall.
Mm-hmm. So I would wait until this fall when it goes dormant, or even better, do it first thing in the spring before you, as soon as the snow's gone and the ground thaws and before you really see much growth. At this point with the leaves that fully expanded, I think you're going to do more harm than good. You probably could do it and it'd be fine, but I would definitely wait till the fall or first thing in the spring. And by fall, I mean, you know, end of September, early October.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for that call. And let's take another question from our audience here. Hi, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Bob. And I was just wondering, with your straw bale gardening, which way do you put the bales? With the strings up or the strings facing out? And then there's two different sides to the bale that doesn't have the strings on it. There's the cut side and then also the uncut side. Which way do you put the bales when you plant?
I put the bales with the sort of the strings facing. So
they're both out. They're both facing out.
Yeah, they're facing out, and so you want the cut side up.
Okay.
And then you, it's about a 10-day process or so of seasoning, where you're using about a half a cup of fertilizer and 1 day, and then you water that bale down, and then water it again the next day without the fertilizer. Then you. The third day, you're back to a half a cup of fertilizer, and you get down to the end, you're at about that last day, they say, you know, like a cup of fertilizer and water it in really good. And by the 10th day, you know, you stick your hand out in there, it's getting warm, getting pretty warm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much all I do for the tomatoes. I stick the tomato plants right in the with whatever little soil that is with the tomato plant when I get it. So Don't add any other dirt, for tomatoes anyway. Let's take a call from Andrea in Milwaukee next. Hi, Andrea.
Hi there, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say I love the show. And luckily enough, my husband and I will be in the Bayfield and Ashland area this weekend looking for a homestead and actually a small farm. And my question is twofold. First, I'm interested in knowing a little bit more about the farmers markets in the area because we're interested in starting a market garden. And more specifically, I'd like to know about CSAs, or community-supported agriculture, in the area because that's the type of farming we're mostly interested in. And I'm just wondering if there's an interest in the area.
Oh, wonderful. Well, that's a great question. And I bet you both Art and Jason will have some comments. But Art, start with you.
Well, I'll be the Bayfield booster here and tell you that you should contact the Bayfield Chamber of Commerce and get all the information that you possibly can from them. And I'm sure that they will be very, very helpful to you.
Yeah, and Jason, I'm sure Extension is going to be a helping hand, too.
Sure. Both CSA and farmers markets are alive and well in Ashland and Bayfield County, and the farmers markets in particular can always use more vendors. CSA is definitely doing well. Just have to keep in mind that our population up here is pretty small compared to outside urban areas, and so how many can make it up here? Who knows? But the more people that are offering shares and the more customers that are interested and have good experiences, then the better off the CSAs will be. So,
yeah. So there you go, Andrea. And the Chamber of Commerce, probably Arts, that's a pretty good idea. You're going to get probably a listing and know all of the other vendors that are out there. Probably Extension's got something like that as mm-hmm. well through UW Extension. You should contact them as well. So lots of good places to go for information. And hey, welcome to Bayfield County and Washburn County. Appreciate your call. Thank you very much, Andrea. Having a lot of fun today here at the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield, Wisconsin, talking with Jason Fishbach, Don Kissinger, and Art Odie on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk, broadcasting from Bayfield, Wisconsin, for kicking off Bayfield in Bloom, which is a wonderful event that it's not just this weekend. It goes on for several months, and you're going to have an opportunity to see some wonderful flowers and some wonderful landscapes when you get to this part of the state. It's just a beautiful, beautiful time. Right now we're looking at some, about as many daffodils as you're ever going to see anywhere, I think. You may have a question about your garden, or maybe it's your tree, or maybe it's your lawn. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And I want to take one call here from Sharon, who's been waiting a while. Sharon, hi, from Green Lake County. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'm out here weeding my garden and finding new things coming up. A couple of things.
Good.
You talked about what you plant on top of a mound, septic system.
Yeah.
In magazines this year, they're showing a xeriscape. If you can explain that.
Xeriscape.
Yeah. You know, like you like they use in the Southwest, like they use on sand. They cover the mound, and they put some gravel on top, and then you put in things like sedums or something that will, not solid, just to kind of halfway decorate it. You don't have to mow it then. And any of the, Better Homes and Gardens publications or Fine Gardening, with maybe even the Wisconsin Gardener, might have the pictures of that in it. It's really a simple thing to do, and yet it looks nice.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Thank you, Sharon. I appreciate the call. And I'm glad you brought that septic back up again, because I was talking with the guy who heads Prairie Nursery, and he's got a septic system and a septic mound system, and he's had prairie plants on top of that mound system for 25 years, and he's never had an issue. And in fact, the prairie plants, I think, the reason the DNR advocates for them is that they use a lot of the materials for their own production and growth, so they actually make it sort of better for the septic system itself if you have those prairie plants that run those roots down really deep. So thank you again, and let's take another question from the audience. Hi, what's your name?
I'm Elaine from Ashland. Mm-hmm. I have another rhubarb question.
Sure.
I have a variety of rhubarb that's already turning to seed. So
wow.
That's happened last year too, and I'm wondering what's going on.
Wow. That's pretty, and you're in Ashland.
Yes.
Yeah. I wouldn't think, Jason, it'd be turning to seed this quickly.
No, and we see that sometimes. It's usually the plant isn't doing all that well, or sometimes it's really young. It'll send up those flower stalks. So in either case, just pinch them off as soon as you see them.
Okay.
And that'll help keep the plant vegetative.
That's what I've been
doing. Oh, okay. That makes good sense. And we've got...
thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I know there's more... people in the audience with questions, but let's go to Tammy in Wausau next. Tammy, hi.
Hi. I have two Honeycrisp apple trees that I planted about 6 years ago. They're about 50 feet apart, 40, 50 feet apart, and we've never had a blossom.
How many years ago?
6 years ago.
Did you plant them? Six, okay. Wow. Art, what do you think?
Well, sounds like too much fertility to me. Either you might be fertilizing your lawn way too much, or if you are fertilizing your trees, don't do it for a while. I'm not really an orchardist, but I know in other situations that I'm familiar with, a last resort would be to sever the roots, maybe out 10 or 15 feet from the tree so that they aren't collecting nutrients from afar. But I would get more advice on that.
Yeah, Jason?
So a couple of things is if it's been that long, you haven't had flowers, you could be just a cumulative circumstances. So the last couple of years, we've had a lot of damage to apple trees because of the winter. So you may have lost a couple of years there. You may have had the trees just still young the years before that, and so nothing necessarily wrong with the tree. You just got unlucky. Now, a tree that old should be flowering. So a couple of things is to look at the way it's being pruned or trellised. And Honeycrisp, if you're getting them from a nursery, typically you're going to be on a semi-dwarf rootstock, and so you should expect flowering within the year or two after it's transplanted. If not, then try to start training those branches down or horizontal. They should be growing out at a 60 to 90 degree angle, and you can do that with spanners. You can do that by actually tying branches down. You can put a trellis up with wire guide wires to be able to prune those down. So just go online and look at an apple pruning publication. Put extension in the search line to make sure you get a good quality publication. It'll walk you through the pruning process. If you do that this year, you will have flowers next year, even if the plant's particularly vigorous. You're just trying to take some of that vigor out with the training.
Mm-hmm. Somebody told me, and it was an extension person, he once took a baseball bat to one of his trees, and he got it to flower.
Yeah, and you... And if the trees will respond to stress by flowering. That's why when they're not flowering, that's in some ways a good sign. They're real healthy. So the baseball bat disturbs the cambium, or you can actually score the branch where you cut in the cambium, and you'll stimulate flowering, or root pruning. But generally, you don't want to do that. Just just manipulate the branch angles, and you'll get flowering.
You're better off. He said it felt good.
Well, or at least you don't want to do it during daylight where others are looking at you.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, let's take another question from the audience. Hi, what's your name?
Linda, and I'm from south of Duluth.
Okay.
And I have a problem with army worms. They love rose bushes and peonies and the rest of the garden.
Yeah, army worms.
Any suggestions besides poisoning them?
Well, if it depends. You know, there's army worms, there's forest tent caterpillars, and there's eastern tent caterpillars. Sounds to me it could be... Well, you could be lucky and have all three. We've actually had all of them out these days. We also have gypsy moth. You probably don't have that high of a level of population yet. So with these caterpillars, if it's a isolated couple of shrubs, it's hand picking and just being vigilant about it. If it's an eastern tent caterpillar, you'll see the nests somewhere in the crotches of branches and the webbing, and you'll just pull those out with your hand and squish them. Otherwise, you're looking at an insecticide, and there are organic materials. Spinosad is the active ingredient. One sometimes sold as a potato bug beater. Or looking at a BT product, and you're going to want to spray those in the evening so they don't break down, and then the bugs will come in contact with it, because most of those are contact or ingested insecticides. But those worms can do a lot of damage. We've also had some moths that flew in with larvae 2 years ago, and had a fair amount of caterpillar activity the last few years. So persistence, hand-picking, or looking at one of those insecticide products.
There's thousands of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, these come and go, these infestations, and, depending on where you are right now, you might be peaking that infestation. It should die off in the next couple of years, but I feel your pain. We've had it move through our place, too.
There was a gentleman in, I think, lower Michigan that had a solution a couple of years ago, and he was inundated with the army worms, and he picked them and picked them and picked them, and finally decided that they were so juicy that he would mash them up and make wine out of them.
And with that, I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and for this edition of Garden Talk, we are broadcasting live again this year from Bayfield in Bloom. We're at the Bayfield Pavilion with a huge crowd and talking with our guest experts today about choosing the right plants. Some of had some questions about plant disease. We've had some questions about gardening conditions. And our guests are doing a great job of answering those questions. Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. And Jason, thank you again for being with us. Appreciate it.
Sure. Happy to do it.
Don Kissinger, Urban and Community Forest Coordinator for the Wisconsin DNR. And Don, great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you as well. Bye.
And Art Odie, Horticulture Consultant, semi-retired from Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. Art, great to have you back.
Good to be here.
Appreciate it. And certainly if you have a question, and if you listen to the credentials of our guest experts today, you know that the pretty broad range of questions, that could be trees, it could be lawns, it could be flowers, it could be the garden. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And before we take a question, I did want to mention that I'm the one that kind of gets the credit here, because I'm the one that does probably the least amount of work. There's a lot of people who actually do a lot of work to make programs like this possible, and I just wanted to mention John Munson and John Talcott, our engineer today, Jennifer Dargan, Cheryl Gasser, Dave Potratz, Jason Fishbach, of course, Don Kissinger, Art Odie, Judith Sears Poisson, who is in France right now as we speak with a group of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, and Chris Molina is handling the microphone today for the audience. So big thanks to everybody who helps, who really plays the big role in getting the show on and all. I get to all the fun. I get to go up here and ask questions and talk smart sometimes, and sometimes not so smart. So, given all that, I hope you'll join in with your questions. And Anita in Lindenhurst, Illinois, has a question. So let's go to Anita. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, great program. I'm I don't know. I'm very, very confused about what to plant under a very large 30-year-old fir tree that the bottom branches are dead, and our new neighbor would like some grass on his side since that goes over to the lot line, and has asked me to trim off and give it, a curtain, so to speak. And so when I trim that up and I trim off those dead branches,
you know, there's hardly anything that will grow under there, and then it just looks ugly. But I don't want to plant something that's going to be a detriment to the poor little old tree either. So I was wondering if you could give me some advice on what I can plant under there to cover up the bare space after I trim it.
Well, there are plants that are going to grow in shady conditions, I know of situations like yours. Jason, you have a tip or a comment?
I wouldn't be worried so much about the effect of the pine needles. I mean, want to test that soil, see what the pH is for sure. That'll give you some clue. But the bigger limitation is the shade, and if you're going to prune that up a bit, that'll help. It depends how much side light's coming in. You know, for your where your location is, where I work is so far away that you're probably best consulting with your local extension office to find the right varieties and species to match those conditions. But if you tell them, hey, I've got a soil that's, you know, clay loam or a sandy loam, and the pH is, you know, 5.5 or 6, and it's pretty shady, they'll be able to provide you with the list of plants that'll do well in those conditions.
Yeah. But you're going to have success. I mean,
for sure.
You definitely will have some success. Good luck with it, Anita. Thank you. Donna, here's an interesting question from Donna posted online. She's a mail carrier, rural mail carrier from Luck, Wisconsin, and she called to recommend against planting flowers that attract bees right next to the mailbox, which I can understand why. And she also said that they have very good luck if you keep putting a dryer sheet in the mailbox to keep the insects out, the bugs out. So she says, please stick a dryer sheet in your mailbox. And then she says, do you have guests have any recommendations on keeping birds from sitting on mailboxes and getting their droppings on the latch? That's the last part. I don't know that we could help too much with that one.
Yeah, maybe just putting a little perch out the backside of the mailbox.
That's not a bad idea. Give them someplace else to sit. I kind of like that idea.
Just make sure it's a little bit higher than the latch in the mailbox. They'll probably sit on that first.
And I hadn't, the dryer sheet, I had never heard that. So that's, and obviously this is something near and dear to her heart. So, Donna, thanks. And let's take a question from the audience. Hi.
Hi, I'm Leroy from Greetings from the Land of the Minnesota Public Radio.
Excellent.
And we have discovered ants, a big ant mound in our center of our garden, mm-hmm. probably 2 foot in diameter, and very active live ant colony.
Yeah.
We want to plant something there. What do we do?
Need to get down, deep down to where the queen is what you need to do if you want to get rid of the thing. If I'm not mistaken, Jason.
Yeah, it's in the garden. You're digging in there anyway. You can just dig it out and get down in there and try to find the main colony and disturb it, and that should take care of the problem. You can combine that with a lot of water, too, but basically just digging that out. And the other part, too, if it's a ways away from the house and you're not, you know, there's no reason for them to go in the house typically anyway, but it's just live with the ant mound. You know, the ants are part of the natural system out there too, and if you plant around it, but they can get big and they can make a garden look ugly, so understand. But that's typically in that situation probably just good elbow grease and digging out that
or even you can take a pole, if you got a metal pole or something, go right down the middle of it and go down as deep as you can, and then boiling water, hot water down the hole. You don't have to use a chemical. If you hot water, what you want to do is, if you want to get rid of it, you need to get rid of the queen.
Can we just plant on top of it to dig a hole and plant?
They'll continue to excavate around it and move things around, and the plants on the top of anthills just never survive. They'll hold on for a little while, but there's too much movement and activity underneath that plant. The roots get exposed.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for that question. Frieda Marie in Madison. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I tried today, 14 days ago, the straw bale method. And my straw bale first heated up wonderfully and everything. Then on Tuesday this week, it got so cold and a lot of rain, and it stopped cold.
And I put more fertilizer on it, thinking I could start it again, but it does not do anything. What do I do now?
I think it's going to start up again. I don't know.
Yep. Yeah, you know, the 10 to 14 days is a rule of thumb. It just depends on the weather conditions. If it's cold and dreary out, the bale just won't decompose as quickly. So once it warms up again here and the sun comes out, it'll restart. Now, in some cases, if you were warm and it went really fast, you may have burned up a lot of that carbon and the biological activity has slowed down a bit. But most likely, it's just sitting there waiting for warmer weather.
Yeah, it's going to pick back up. I wouldn't worry about that for sure. And at least that's been my experience. Not that I'm the great expert, but I do enjoy having those straw bales. And as I think I mentioned on the show, it's kind of nice to have one right next to the back door where I come in from the. And I've got a cherry tomato plant there every year, and it's just, you know, every time you walk by, you grab a handful of cherry tomatoes, and it's kind of a nice little snack. Let's go back to the audience here. Hi.
Hi. I'm Linda from Superior, and we're in the process of redoing flower beds at a house mm-hmm. we bought this early fall. And there is one place that has nothing. I want to put a nice perennial bed in. It's on the east side of the house, but it gets a lot of shade because by noon the sun is on the other side and there's some bigger trees out in front. What would be a good suggestion for some perennials that would, I want things that flower a lot during the season, not just green, that would work with quite a bit of shade? And Superior clay.
Superior clay. Alrighty. There's some thought process going on here among our experts. Art, do you want to take a shot first?
I don't know. Excuse me. I don't know if you'd consider this actually a desirable perennial, but for ground cover in a situation like that, sweet woodruff would do very, very well. And that, by the way, would be a good suggestion for under the fir tree that the caller called about, too. So sweet woodruff and lily of the valley. Of course, you only have a short period of flowering, but then you have fruit afterwards. Those are two good shade plants.
Yeah. Yeah, those are good suggestions. Thank you.
And the hostas, of course.
Yeah, they're always going to work. Ron in Newburgh, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I've always been used to taking a batch of topsoil and a batch of commercial mix and mix them together. You get a little bit more that way, and you got a good batch of soil. The last couple of years, if you do that, you mix commercial with plain topsoil, and you end up with concrete. Anybody seen the same problem?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is pretty common for, in my master gardener classes, I call this the cheap husband syndrome. So instead of buying two bags of potting soil for your container gardens, this is particularly where it matters, is you go out in the backyard and dig out some soil and cut it half and half, and well, you save money, right? So what happens is it dries out and it turns to concrete. And once it's dried out, it's really hard to get water back into that soil and to get it resaturated. So that's why in container gardens and pots on hot, sunny places, you definitely want to go with the soil as potting mixes because retains moisture a little bit better. It doesn't turn to concrete, and you can re-wet it, which is the big part.
That's the big part. Yeah, there you go, Ron. Let's take another call from Duluth, Minnesota this time. Pat, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We took down a mountain ash tree this week, and it did really well. It was mature when we moved into our house over 20 years ago, and I've been researching to replace it. And the site is full sun. It's clay soil. We're zone 4. We're really close to Lake Superior, like right across the bridge from Superior, Wisconsin. And two trees that I've thought about are hackberry, and that's Celtis occidentalis, or red oak. And I just was wondering, because I know that red oak isn't right along Lake Superior's shore, but it is inland from us a bit. And hackberry, I don't think it's up this far north, but we're technically Zone 4. So I was just wondering if you have any thoughts on those as being a good replacement for this mountain ash.
Both those trees would do well. However, they're going to be much larger than the mountain ash. Actually, the hackberry is my all-time favorite. It is very similar in form to an American elm, and it has a nice warty bark to it. It does get some nipple gall, which is inherent to any hackberry tree. You also do get little berries on there, but they're pretty inconspicuous. I think actually the oak might do a little bit better, but I think they're both good possibilities.
Yeah.
On the oak, instead of the red oak, you might consider something like swamp white oak. In our region up here around Bayfield, where we have these alternating clay and sandy soils, we tend to see red oak on the sandier ground, and then on the clay, every once in a while, we'll find a swamp white oak. And it just depends on, you know, there's clay and then there's clay. If this is red clay that nothing ever drains, try the swamp red or swamp white oak. If it's decent site and things grow okay and there's a little more loam in that clay, then the red oak should do okay.
We got thousands of trees on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus, and I think my favorite tree on the whole campus is a swamp white oak, a big old-timer that is just absolutely gorgeous. That's a beautiful tree, beautiful tree.
Another,
the hackberries are wonderful, too.
Another nice tree that would give you some of the aspects of the mountain ash would be either American or European linden, and that should do well for you there, too. And they flower nicely, not real conspicuous, but they flower nicely, and they're very, very fragrant. So that's another option for you there.
Some very good options for you, Pat. Good luck, and thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take another question from the audience.
I live in the Rice Lake area, and I really like the looks of a ginkgo tree, but I don't know anything about them. Can you give me some of the pros and cons of the ginkgo trees?
Oh, sure thing. Don?
Ginkgo trees, I mean, they're from China, basically. Some people don't like them because the fact that it is not a native. However, living in a community, and I work with urban areas, there's nothing that's native in your urban area because the soil has been, you know, basically ransacked. It's a great, it can handle pollutants, it can handle salt, it's going to do wonderful. It's a slow grower, I'll tell you that much. It's a slow grower, but it has a neat fan-shaped leaf. You want to make sure, and pretty much all they sell is the male variety, because the female, if you get the fruit, does smell quite a bit. But the ginkgo is a great tree.
All right. There we go.
Thank you.
Our urban forestry program, by the way, is 25 years old this year.
Yes, it is. And that's, we've been doing a lot of things in that regard. One of the big things that we've been doing is we have a grants program that's gone over that period of time. We've given each year $500,000-$600,000, and we've given it to thousands of villages, nonprofits, tribal governments, helping them to take care of their community forestry programs, doing inventories, then using the funds to actually implement the inventories, teaching their staff, because a lot of the staff that we have in our communities aren't full-time forestry-type staff. So that's some of the things that we've been doing with them. So, yes, 25 years, and it's just keeps growing.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful program. If you go to the DNR website and type in Urban Forestry Program, you'll find more out on it, and there's information there on how to get grants as well, if I'm not mistaken, Don.
Yes, there is. And we have several different grants. We've got, yesterday I was in Butternut. They received what was called a startup grant, and that's for typically, but not always, smaller communities. But we give these grants out for only 3 years for the startup grant, and one of the stipulations is one of those 3 years they must do some type of inventory, because we don't want to keep giving funds to these communities without them realizing what needs to be done long term. We just don't want them to be planting or pruning or whatever. We want them to know why and where and that kind of stuff.
And Art, you were going to add to that.
Well, I just wanted to emphasize how important that program has been to the city of Bayfield. It really got us up and running and has kept us running. And there's very good news from the standpoint of the funding of that grant, it was those grants were set to be eliminated in in the next budget biennium, and they have been restored. So that's very good news, particularly well for all communities, particularly small communities.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah, and actually with the grants, the form that they were in was going to be changed. The grants would still be around, but they were going to change the format of how it was done. So it would be less proactive, whereas what we have now is a very proactive program to use those funds.
That's very good information there, and appreciate it. And maybe we have time for John in Washburn. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm on my great-grandfather's Pioneer Farm, and we have two trees on the east side of the house. They were planted in approximately 1898, a double trunk basswood, and then an ash, I believe a white ash. I'd like to know what is our risk with the emerald ash borer up here, and what is the longevity that I should expect with these trees? Both of them are in excess of 80 feet high now.
Okay. In a minute or less?
The concern about emerald ash borer is basically anywhere in the Midwest it could be here. As I said, signs, symptoms, you may not see that for 2 or 3 years. So that's the situation. Your trees being, you know, close to 100 plus years old, they're definitely more towards... not as many good days as there were days before. So I would say maybe 20, 30 years maximum you're going to have with those trees. Probably a little more with ash than the linden, I think you said, was the other tree.
And there are treatments for emerald ash borer, and it's for the tree like that, if you want to keep it, there are ways that you can keep it.
Correct. For the larger trees, you would probably want to work with a certified arborist to do chemical injections. With the smaller trees, you can use just some homeowner stuff that you mix with water that you can put around the trunk that is viable.
Well, I tell you what, this has been a wonderful program today, and we've covered a whole broad range of things to kick off Bayfield in bloom, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Jason, Don, and our Jason Fishbach, UW Extension Ag Agent for Ashland and Bayfield Counties. We have Don Kissinger with us as well, Urban and Community Forestry Coordinator with the Wisconsin DNR, and Art Odie, Horticulture Consultant, semi-retired from Botanical Garden and Arboretum Management. And I'm hoping that 365 days or so from now we'll be able to do this all over again. It's been wonderful having you with us.